The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis.
And I'm Kieran Yates. Coming up, a rare appearance from the Beach Boys and Singles Club, a musical call to arms from Louise Distra, plus we talk to Stanley Booth, the man who left no Rolling Stone unturned for a classic rock and roll book about the band.
All here on Music Weekly from The Guardian. Joining us this week, Michael Hann. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Alexis.
How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. But you know, this week,
what?
My big musical passion, not big star that I keep tweeting out.
Is it like an Americana?
It's not Steps. Steps on the Road Again. I love the Steps reunion program.
Why?
But Steps on the Road Again is even better, not least because every program begins with, when Steps split, it was one of the most cataclysmic events in history.
Yeah. Though I saw a bit of it last night, actually. Like a little flicking, you know, on telly. And it was Lisa Scott Lee and Claire with curly hair.
That's Faye with the curly hair.
Faye, right. Faye Tully.
Claire's the one with the weight issues.
And she was going, it's just... Well, she was filling up, you know, Lisa Scott Lee. And she goes, it's just so hard being in Steps at the moment. And I thought, yeah, I bet there's a lot of squaddies in Basra just weeping for you, love.
the other
get out there and mime.
The other thing I love watching this week's episode was seeing them complain bitterly about, you know, their grueling promo schedule. They're complaining bitterly about their grueling promo schedule during the course of a multi-part TV series to promote their comeback. Come on.
What's the big music news this week? What's happened? Anything exciting? What's the big story? I'll tell you what the big story is. I'll tell you what the big music news is. Adele, 21 by Adele, has outsold Thriller by Michael Jackson in Britain.
Every week there's this story as it creeps fractionally higher up the list of top 10 selling albums of all time.
Who's I can still buying say those it? Words. Who's everyone still, heard it?
I said that.
I'm actually buying 3,000 copies a week.
Okay.
You should see my bank account. It's in terrible state.
It's an amazing thing to have sold more copies than Thriller, don't you think? I mean, that really is like the benchmark of kind of enormo sales. And this is an album that's been out, what, 2 years? And it's outsold Thriller?
Although, I think one of the incredible things, I know people say Adele is kind of unavoidable, but those songs are not, I think, in the consciousness in the way that Thriller and Billie Jean and Beat It and Human Nature were. I mean, I think those songs were genuinely unavoidable 30 years ago in a way that the Adele songs aren't in the same way. Part of that is because there's much less... Part of that, Alexis, wait, is because there's much less pop on TV, so you're not seeing the videos every 10 minutes on every programme.
I think that unavoidable is probably the adjective I would use to characterise someone like you by Adele.
Okay.
But the rest of them, I admit, you don't hear Rolling in the Deep all the time, all that kind of thing. Mm. I just think it's an amazing an amazing achievement.
She has got amazing feet.
They're planted firmly on the ground.
I'm here all week, trying to land.
Right, anyway, that's that. Well done, Adele. Stanley Booth's The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones, published in 1984, has been hailed as a classic and has now been given a new lease of life in a smart reissue by Canongate. Sean O'Hagan talked to the author about how one of the great rock and roll books came into being.
I'd like to start, Stanley, by asking you how you first came in contact with the Rolling Stones.
I came to London in September of 1968 and went to the Stones office, and they were expecting me. I met them, and luckily I first talked to Ian Stewart and told him I was from Memphis and I knew B.B. King, and he called the other Stones, and they never thought of me as a reporter or a critic. They just thought of me as another musician. And I got to know Keith, got to know Charlie, and eventually got to know all of them. And Brian and I actually got on very well. I didn't know Brian long enough for him to do anything bad to me.
And would it be fair to say that it was your deep knowledge of the blues and the South that made the connection with them, the fact that you could introduce them to these sort of people that they worshipped?
Absolutely. They had B.B. King's albums, but I knew B.B. I could introduce them. I did introduce them to B.B. and Booger White and other musicians. We were all real blues disciples.
So when it came to writing this book, you actually, I suppose it was one of the first books that sort of took the form seriously. You wrote it almost as a novel.
Yeah.
You very much caught the mythology of the time and the mythology of the Stones. Was that something that you thought about retrospectively, or were you aware of that when you first met them?
No, I didn't. I had no desire to write a book about an old rock and roll band. But as I got to know them, I liked them more and more, and I liked their music more and more. And they had a wonderful press agent, a man named Les Perrin, who had been Louis Armstrong's press agent and Frank Sinatra's press agent. And Les and I kind of fell in love. He was like an English bulldog, and he suggested that I write a book about the Stones. And I really wasn't interested in doing that. But a few months after that, Brian died, and he was 26 or 27, and I became much more interested in doing a book because it was obviously something profoundly dysfunctional about this group, and it was a mystery to me why this should be. And so when they came to America in 1969, I went out to Los Angeles and imposed myself on their hospitality and just never left until after the free concert at Altamont.
The book begins very, very dramatically. I think it's one of the most evocative passages in the book where you go with Mick and Keith the night before the concert at Altamont to the site.
Yeah.
And there are a few sort of intimations of what might happen. It's a very sort of ragged, disorganized place.
Oh, yeah.
And Keith actually stays there?
He doesn't go back. He stayed all that night. And Mick and I went back to the hotel. We got a few hours sleep. And the next day we went out on a helicopter to the site of the concert. And Mick got off the helicopter, and somebody came up and hadn't heard about Peace and Love and hit Mick in the mouth. And Mick kind of disappeared after that. And there was a caravan behind the stage where we went to wait for the show. And I remember hearing the burritos in the distance as we walked toward that caravan. And there were like 500,000 people there.
Was there a sense already that that things weren't right?
Yeah. Michelle Phillips came into our caravan and told us about the angels bouncing beer cans off people's heads and just being generally violent and obstreperous. And as the day progressed, things got worse and worse. The reason we went on so late, we were going to go on at sunset, but Wyman overslept and couldn't be bothered to get up and join the rest of the band. And things deteriorated. The angels were taking methadrine and acid and whatever they could get their hands on. And they were not happy campers.
You had trailed the Stones on that tour, and there was nothing in the other indoor gigs to suggest that anything like this would be.
Nothing. Every scene, as Mick said, every scene has been cool. Why are we fighting and what for? And the angels were poleaxing people with pool cues. They had pool cues with lead in the handles, and they were just knocking people out one way and then the next.
So the crucial mistake was to employ those guys as a security.
They didn't. Nobody employed them.
I thought the Grateful Dead employed them. The
Grateful Dead didn't have any right to employ anybody. The Angels just showed up. I mean, 500,000 people showed up, and 500 of them were Angels. And the Angels are very brutal people, and they behaved like the people they are.
Did you yourself, I mean, could you describe the sense? Did you feel physically threatened?
Absolutely. It was a sensation like I imagine being in Vietnam. You had the feeling that you could die the next minute and there was nothing you could do to change that.
And, of course, some people did die. And
yeah.
Famously, Meredith Hunter.
Yeah.
I just watched Gimme Shelter again recently. And
yeah.
There's no denying that he has a gun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he pulled a gun. It was most unwise.
And was he pulling a gun against the Angels or against the Stones?
Oh, he was not pulling... the Angels didn't like black people anyway.
Yeah.
And they kept pushing him. He was with a white girl. He was 18 years old. And they were right up in close to the front of the stage. And Angels kept pushing Hunter away, and suddenly he pulls this nickel-plated revolver, and when he did that, he signed his death warrant. Mm-hmm. This little sawed-off Angel jumped up in the air and came down with burying a knife in Meredith Hunter's carotid artery, and if somebody had done that to him in an operating room, he couldn't have been saved.
Yeah.
They just executed him.
So what happens after you then depart from the Stones camp to go off and write this book?
I came back to London with the Stones and spent several months here and spent a lot of time with Keith. And
getting into trouble?
Well, not getting into trouble, but... we did indulge in some daredevil behavior. And finally, I realized that I was going down a road that could lead to my destruction. And I came back to America and continued working for on the book, which took years to complete. But
why did it take so long exactly?
Well, I had to become somebody different from the person who went on the tour. I mean, I really opened my nose wide for the whole experience. And I had to devise a new persona in order to tell the story.
Do you have any regrets about that time?
No, not really. I mean, I regret things that happened. I regret Brian's death and Graham's death, and I lost so many friends during that period. I'm still losing them.
Did you realize back then that Keith was a classic survivor?
No, I didn't know. We didn't know who was a survivor and who wasn't. I knew Keith was one of the strongest personalities I'd ever been around. He was inspiring. The Stones were inspiring. I'd never seen people work harder than the Stones in the studio.
And given that you had a great love for and were a great chronicler of the blues and of country music and soul music, all the stuff that inspired the Stones, in fact, there is a sense along the way that tradition and that lineage has been lost somewhere.
Yeah, it's is a sad thing.
What happened, do you think?
Well, the society changed, the music business changed. On the 1969 tour, there were like maybe seven or eight of us. And now the Stones go on tour and they have like 100 people setting up these huge stages. And I find it a deplorable development, but the Stones are sort of victims of their own success.
It also strikes me, looking at this book and also the other great book that you wrote, Rhythm Oil, the essays about blues and country and stuff, that a lot of what you write about is something that's passing or endangered,
mm-hmm.
like the last of things.
Absolutely.
The incredible, beautiful essay about Furry Lewis, for instance.
Thank you. Yeah, I realized as I was doing those pieces, at a certain point, I realized that I was describing the progress of something that was endangered. And when we lost people like Otis Redding, they couldn't be replaced.
Of course, you actually had the great good fortune to meet Otis Redding.
I had the great good fortune to sit and watch Otis and listen to Otis write Dock of the Bay and listen to him record it. And
very shortly before he died.
I said goodbye to him on Friday night and he died on Sunday.
Could you describe him?
I was mesmerized. He was just had such positive energy. And he was a delight to be around. I've never gotten over his death.
Did you have literary influences and heroes that you looked towards when you were writing this book?
Oh, absolutely. Evelyn Waugh.
That's a surprising one.
I love Evelyn Waugh. Raymond Chandler. I tried to make every sentence in this book like a line spoken by Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler's fictional detective character. And I had a lot of heroes, a lot of spirits I felt looking over my shoulder. And I tried to tune into their vibrations. And I think these were some of the better angels. And I think they did help me complete this book. It took me years, but I managed to survive and finish it. And now it's out again in a pretty new edition, and I'm very, very blessed to have had this happen.
Well, I think the pleasure's all ours. It's a really, really great book and absolutely stands up to the test of time, which, of course, is the ultimate test of any work of art or literature.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you for coming, Stanley. I appreciate it. It's great to talk to you, finally.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
That was Sean O'Hagan talking to Stanley Booth. The true issue of The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones is published by Canongate. Michael, you're a fan.
Amazing book, The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones, and a book whose research traumatized Stanley Booth so much that it took him, you know, more than a decade to actually write the thing. It's a history of the Rolling Stones that ends in 1969 and then gets published 15 years later. But, I mean, the stuff about Altamont in there is incredible. If you read that and watch Gimme Shelter at more or less the same time, it's an incredible insight into the strangeness of the Stones. But his other stuff is amazing too. There's a book called Rhythm Oil, which is collected essays. There's a fantastic essay about Elvis returning to Memphis after having been to Hollywood in the late 50s, with a story which he is being asked by his buddies whether it's true that he performed Cunnilingus upon Natalie Wood.
Wow.
That's just all priceless stuff.
Oh, there you go. I tell you what, traumatised by being on the road of the Rolling Stones in 1969.
Who'd have thunk it?
Mid-90s, I went to interview Bentley Rhythm Ace in Birmingham, right? And the one out of Bentley Rhythm Ace that used to be in Pop Lead Yourself took all his clothes off in a bowling alley while I was trying to interview him.
And it's only now you can talk about it.
And that's the first time I've mentioned it, ever since it happened. There you go. Anyway, right, let's bring on the Mighty Singles Club. Michael, let's hear what you've brought in.
That's why God made the radio.
That's the Beach Boys. They're back, back, back. Who would have believed that was going to happen?
Brian is back.
Brian is back again. What? I don't remember.
After how long?
We're referring in the 70s. Right. There was the Brian is back campaign, where after years of him being in no fit state to go near a recording studio, they lured him back in, more or less just to sit there. And then the subsequent album was launched with the Brian is back campaign.
Okay. Desperately mentally ill guy with a catastrophic drug problem.
I've got to say, when I first heard it, when I was listening through it, thinking, it sounds like the Beach Boys. It's all a bit pedestrian, isn't it? I've heard these kind of lyrics before. I've heard this verse before. But then the chorus, it just explodes into life in the chorus. Those properly Brian Wilson chord changes, completely unexpected.
Yes, it is
go to places you didn't dream that would make sense, and they do, and they knit together and come back to the verse. A very reassuring comeback. I have a suspicion this song might have been around for a while. I don't know for certain. I've been looking it up. But things, Jeffrey Fisket in a Mojo interview with the Beach Boys saying, yeah, the guys were really surprised when they heard it, but we knew how good that song was, suggesting that it had been floating around Brian and his touring band for quite a long time.
There's a lot of question about where that material on Brian Wilson's solo albums comes from anyway, because there was certainly the last one, Getting In Over My Head. Mm. There was tracks on there that were off that. The second album he made with Eugene Landy, Sweet Insanity.
Yeah, no, I've got selections of Beach Boys bootlegs that feature songs that turned up on Brian Wilson later.
I agree with you. I think that's a more than creditable, return. Because I actually think Brian Wilson, I've got to be brutally honest with you here, I think most of Brian Wilson's solo albums are rubbish.
Yeah.
And are not of a standard. And there's a lot of special pleading on behalf of Brian Wilson.
Definitely,
And understandably so. You know, I remember when I interviewed him last year, and, got the usual 20 minutes of halting monosyllables, and so had to do some interviews around it. And one of the people I spoke to, Van Dyke Parks, and found a very garrulous man, and he came on the phone and said, so you're writing a piece about Brian. Be kind, Alexis, be kind. And I thought, wow, that's actually, it really sort of put me on the back foot.
I mean,
because I think everybody knows there's something desperately wrong there, but...
Yeah, I think the thing, people are kind to him because it would do such a disservice to one of the great figures in pop history to treat him solely as if he were only what we have seen in recent years. However, if his arrangements are what is bringing this music to life now, I mean, that's an incredible recovery. I have no idea whether any of his touring bands are involved in the arrangements of the new album. But by all accounts, some of this stuff is terrific. I had an email in the middle of the night last night from The Guardian's Paul Lester telling me he'd been sent a stream of a handful of the tracks and saying that a couple of them were as good as anything by the Beach Boys. Now, Lester may, of course, have been drunk. I don't know.
That may have something to do with the hour that he was emailing about.
He was genuinely excited and clearly wanted to share this news with someone, and I'm really keen to hear the rest of them on the back of this. But, the song itself, not so much, but the chorus, full marks,
Beach Boys. Lyrics
and the harmonies are as good as ever.
It's good. And Brian Wilson, for a man, his voice does sound very, similar to the way it sounded in his youth. Kieran.
I think it sounds very rooted in a time, doesn't it?
Yes.
Otherwise, it would be called.
Well, exactly. I thought that was really funny. This kind of heralding the radio and its influence at that time, which was quite interesting. And it definitely sounds like you would be on a beach in kind of the 60s on the West Coast, sunning yourself, listening to this. I don't really know how I feel about that, I guess. I mean, I'm not saying that you need Katy Perry to, rip off one of your songs.
It's not right up your street. You really don't want Katy. I mean, of anything you could do.
Yeah, exactly.
To any record. I mean, let's be honest. Yeah. Just get Katy Perry to appear on it.
That's not the way to stay relevant, is to have Katy Perry.
Well, the Beach Boys aren't about relevance. I mean, what you say about it looking back, about it being nostalgic. Well, actually, the Beach Boys, even when they were young, were nostalgic. And I think that's rooted probably in the deep unhappiness that haunted Brian Wilson throughout virtually all of his life.
Certainly there
was. And so who's always, even in his early 20s, who's writing songs that were trying to hark back to some time where he wasn't beset by troubles. He's always trying to find, 1957 or 1958 in his head, and he's been trying to do so since 1962.
There's certainly the band that released Do It Again in 1960. A song kind of going, how amazing the early 60s were in 1969. I mean, this is
68, in fact.
Do It Again 68.
68, yes.
Wow. Anyway.
But it almost has this sense of them bowing out, if you know what I mean. Kind of, when you listen to this, this kind of echo as it fades out is very much like a slow wave, it feels like to me. And there's a really funny lyric in there, which is something like, spreading the love and joy to a whole new generation. And it just seems, you know.
It's fair to say that you rarely go to the Beach Boys for the lyrics, except when they're written by Tony Asher or Van Dyke Parks. There aren't that many occasions you go to them for the lyrics.
I think the lyrical thing of Mike Love is not to be. You know, and I don't want to be a Mike Love hater, because as time wears on within the Beach Boys saga, I actually quite like Mike Love.
Well, Mike Love wrote the lyrics to possibly my favourite Beach Boys song. She Knows Me Too Well, an incredibly sinister, dark song. But also, whenever we mention Mike Love and someone is horrible about him, we have to say, Mike Love, not war.
Mike Love, not war. Yeah, absolutely. He wrote the lyrics to Be True to Your School, which are amazing. Mm. When some loud braggart tries to put me down and say his school is great, I tell him, what's the matter, buddy? Ain't you heard of my school? It's number one in the state. That's fantastic. Yeah, I love that era of the Beach Boys, where it's like this sort of amazing false cockiness. We always take my car because it's never been beamed. We've never missed yet with the girls that we meet. And it's these records made by this man that's totally crippled inside. Anyway, that's all by the by. That's Why God Made the Radio by the Beach Boys, from their forthcoming album,
which I think is cool. That's Why God Made the Radio.
Okay. And it's out in
June, I believe.
June, yeah, absolutely.
I'm looking forward to it, which I wouldn't have said 2 weeks ago before hearing the chorus to that song.
Yeah, it can go either way. I would say,
yeah, caution is always, we know caution is advised, but at least they're giving us reason to hope.
What a lovely sentiment. Kieran's choice. I'm a Aggie spitter and that. I had a vision, but I'm a bigger than that. Not reverse, man, I move fast forward like Satan. I'll see a spin at chat. Mum was like, why you trying to spit like that? Well, mum, before I was off track. But I'm like, cool, right, trying to catch up, so I'm fast and spitting on tracks. Sounds like it's gooder than that. Stick to green like a cat up in the front grass. Fresh air, man, I chat a minimum gas. I'm just chitter and chat, the man, I give it a damn. To the good never challenge, we get a track. And the basic light, they get mad and we give a back. C4-4 slogan, please. Ooh, right. I'm not perfect, though, sometimes I'm off track. That's C4, featuring JME, Frisco and Jammer. That's the BBK remix of Off Track. Kieran, that's your choice.
Yep. That is from C4, who is a sort of Birmingham-born MC, and this is produced by Predator, who is his brother, which kind of gives you a little bit of an insight into how interconnected the grime scene is. Predator, kind of, he's very well known in terms of being a really talented producer on the grime scene. He released Gargoyle last year, which was, you know, massive club track, you can hear everywhere. This is a remix done by JME, Frisco and Jammer of Boy Better Know. And so they're members of Boy Better Know, which, if you don't know, who are a massive grime crew, and they've been around forever, and they had Wiley and their crew in the beginning. And yeah, they're sort of these pioneers on the underground with these great characters. Like Jammer, also known as the Merkle Man, who's a kind of superhero who kind of smokes your troubles away for you. And
someone could do that. Smoke my troubles away.
But, yeah, exactly. He's onto something. The video is just really nice. I just thought that this was really important in terms of having an element of all those things that make grime exciting in 2012 for anyone who might not sort of understand it, or might think that it's just this P-Money hard, you know, high energy 140 BPM thing.
It's certainly not in the vein of a P-Money thing at all.
Yeah,
it's a melodic chorus.
And you can hear all those differences in the voices. You can pick out the difference when JME's emceeing to when Jammer's emceeing. And I think that that's really key in grime. It's really important to pick out those differences and to pick out those characters. You know, Jammer is a kind of, you know, if you cross sort of Bootsy Collins and, you know, a kind of East London rude boy, that's what he looks like. You know, he wears these crazy, you know, bejeweled, you know, outfits. In this video, he's wearing this kind of sequined jumper and a trilby. You know, he's definitely like a weird character. When you see him at, you know, at Eskimo Dance last month, he was just wearing all these crazy, ostentatious chains. And, you know, there's a real sense of comedy and about him. And I think that that's always, well, that can be lost in grime. Those kind of characters can be lost quite a lot. But yeah, I really like this. I like the hook. I think it's quite nice and restrained. I quite like that displacement on the vocals, where you can't really hear the first time what he's saying.
I like the chorus. Okay. I like that kind of that aspect. It reminded me a little bit of Pushing the Feeling On by the Nightcrawlers. That sort of cut-up vocal thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Got an element I quite like that. You have to pay attention, don't you?
Are you thinking they could have maybe employed Katy Perry to make themselves more relevant?
I'll tell you what I'm thinking. Do you think this is the kind of track that might cross over? Because it seems to me that this kind of music exists sort of really quite apart from the mainstream. And, you know, it strikes me that unless you really just go for it as a grime MC and go, you know, sod it, I'll make a record that sounds like Calvin Harris, sorry to harp on, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, that your chances of actually crossing over and getting airplay outside of One Extra and the Pirates is, you know, rinse, is kind of minimal.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very true point to make in terms of what we've seen with people like Tinchy and Tiny and all those kind of buzzword MCs who have crossed over. But I think that when you listen to something like this and you listen to and you think of Boy Better Know as a crew and you think of P Money and you think of Skepta and you think of DEE and you think of all these characters who are incredibly well known, who are really, you know, making a good living out of grime, I think that they're more interesting because they haven't had to make those massive club
bangers. No, it wasn't a comment about the quality of the track. It wasn't a comment about the quality of the rapping. It was just because on one level that is actually quite a commercial sounding record.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no secret to anyone who knows any of my interests in music that this is not an area of special expertise for me. Most of my knowledge of this kind of music comes from where I hear it, which is either on the bus from people's mobile phones or in cars parked on our street where they've got subwoofers. Mm-hmm. And this sounds like it's the people who park on the streets with the subwoofers rather than the kids at the back. It speaks to something that feels closer to the mainstream because it's more grown up because they've got cars rather than being 14, 15-year-olds. Oh. It does feel like a... Yeah, I know that this is a very inexact way of reviewing a record.
it's, you know, everybody's sort of view in the way they perceive music. You know, it's interesting to hear different the way people perceive music and the way music is translated to them.
There's different ideas of how, you know, of its relevance. You know, this week, One Extra just did this big documentary which was called 10 Years of Grime and, you know, Eskimo Dancers, which is kind of a really pioneered night started by Wiley, is on later in the month. And I just think that all these things together is just, you know, in case you didn't already know, it's just kind of proof to how relevant grime is in the UK at the moment and how nationwide it is and how it's not just London-centric.
I take the point. Now, is this available on the internet?
Yes, he's just been signed to the same management company as Boy Better Know, so you can find it on the internet now.
OK, here is my track. That's my track. That's by Snails, who are a duo from Bristol who changed your name. It's a terrible name for a band. That's called She'd Like an Hour. And there is a story behind this. That track actually came out in November, and I would have been sent it in November on a 7-inch single on a label called Great Pop Supplement. But they sent it me, obviously, just as I was moving house, because I found it this weekend in a box full of stuff that I was unpacking that still hadn't been unpacked, and I thought, oh, I'll put this on, and I really liked it. It is still available to download for nothing on the internet, and it's just got, it kind of moves. It starts out like that, and it has a little bit like a sort of more pastoral version of Broadcast, I think, at that point, but then kind of moves into a sort of weird folky
medieval
almost like medieval bit almost all Greek, I actually thought, you know, so slightly almost like bouzouki like guitar playing. I hear the echo of the land of my forefathers in there. The calling of the Acropolis. And I just thought, wow, this is a really nice little record. This is, you know, it ain't changing the world, but it's a nice song. It's very well put together.
Yeah, I quite liked it instrumentally. I wasn't so crazy about the vocal. But yeah, like you say, as it goes into that kind of medieval marching, maybe even a bit Robin Hoodie type thing towards the end, I quite liked that bit, and I thought, oh yeah.
One of the things I still like about indie music is the way it throws up these groups who you hear one song by and think, Isn't that marvellous? Mm. And you're never going to hear from them again. About 8-9 years ago, there was an American group called Scotland Yard Gospel Choir who had a song called Good Kind of Crazy that I loved to pieces. Right. And I don't think I ever heard anything else by them ever again.
No, there's a bit. I had a little look on the internet for information about snails. And obviously, found a lot of information about the animal, snails, and very little about the band. The Bandcamp site had the two tracks off the single available for free download.
I like that idea of you having to search out for all that information, though, because for me that just seems like so... When you've been covering underground music for such a long time, it's just natural. It's just like you would assume that there's nothing on the internet about it, and you assume that you have to kind of go through this laborious process of finding things. And I think there's a kind of joy to be had there, isn't there?
That's how pop used to be in the old days. This is what we forget. This is some kind of incredible thing. It was really hard to find anything out about them. You know, 35 years ago, it was hard to find anything out about Led Zeppelin, because they didn't do a lot of interviews. There was nothing on the record sleeves.
So the Mysterious Snails, that's available, as I said, I think it's on the Bandcamp website, so you can download it for nothing from there, if you like it.
What would you describe this, then? Is this folk?
I think it's indie pop, actually.
I'd say it was indie. I think is the, you know, it's proper old-fashioned indie music. Although, you know, I think that, like I said, the band it reminds me most of is the great Broadcast.
Broadcast filtered through Bell and Seb.
Yes, there you go.
Okay, some reactions to last week's show. Joe Kiki says, I haven't been as excited by some spoons since Pink Floyd's aborted Household Objects project.
Wow. Did you hear the tracks from Pink Floyd's aborted Household Objects project?
I've seen some of them on YouTube and on documentaries before.
Really quite good. I thought there was one track that was like, it sounded like Massive Attack. It was brilliant.
Like they totally sold out after Syd Barrett left.
Canadian in Oz. Leaving aside the pronunciation of Dohan, did we decide what was
Down?
Down. Gibson's name, which I still haven't got the knack of. I didn't hear all that much country in the bit of his song you played. My guess was Nick Cave doing a Go-Betweens cover. Mm. Nick Cave once made a record with the Go-Betweens, you know.
Don't surprise me.
They made a joint, the birthday party in the Go-Betweens, a joint single together. There you go. I was expecting Alexis to say, this is something Nick handed me in the queue at the local Tesco's. Yeah, my close personal friendship with my fellow Brighton and Hove resident Nick Cave.
Poppy G says, seriously, could we launch a grassroots campaign to make Alina George the biggest new act of 2012? I wish in the coming months Alina George and Jessie Ware would rule the world, or at least the charts.
And rather cryptically, Sinso Tenaka says, I love everything. we'll take that as a compliment. Right, when her mum smashed up a guitar, Louise Distra wrote a song called Bullets and set off on a mission to bring punk, politics and protest back into the musical mainstream. She came in to talk to Charlotte Richardson Andrews about how, with a new album on the way and some famous players on her side, she's planning a musical revolution. Devastation, it hits me like a bullet, but your demons make me broken and betrayed. Your bitterness fills thick in my stomach. I only love you cause you'll never go away. You said, do nothing. I'm Louise Distress. I'm an acoustic punk artist from Wakefield, which is up north. It's just a small northern town that's famous for black lace and rhubarb, really.
So how did you get into acoustic punk?
I actually used to play in like a post-hardcore punk band called Blockades, and then we split up and a lot of things happened, and that sort of was like the catalyst for me going solo, really. And I just wrote a bunch of songs and went on a megabus tour, you know, and then here I am now.
So what made you decide to go from electric punk to acoustic punk?
You know, when you're in a band, you know, basically, if everyone in your group is not on the same level, you know, it's kind of doomed from the start. You know, there's kind of a saying that's, you know, you're only as strong as your weakest member, you know? So it was all kind of, you know, the typical, like, band politics, really, you know? And I just don't need that, you know? I'm a big fan of, you know...
DIY,
yeah, completely. You know, doing things yourself, doing things on your own terms, and not having to, you know, really kind of consider anybody else. You know, or fight for creative control, and that's why I went acoustic. Yeah.
So you've been called the female Frank Turner.
Right.
I see quite a few times in your reviews. I wondered how you felt about that.
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, it's weird. When my hair's black, I get compared to Brody Daly because I've got a kind of husky, gritty voice. And then when it's blonde, I get compared to Courtney Love. And I guess because Frank Turner's experiencing a lot of success at the moment, you know, I guess people would maybe naturally want to compare me to him, you know. But, I mean, personally, I would find a comparison to Billy Bragg or, you know, maybe like Joe Strummer, even though that's quite a high accolade, you know, I would obviously appreciate that one a lot more.
Well, those two are very, very famous kind of, you know, anti-establishment protest singers. Yeah. Do you see yourself in that kind of vein?
100%, definitely. I think that it's important for everyone, you know, to have a voice, and especially artists as well. I just find things nowadays, right across the board, you know, everyone's too apathetic, you know. Everything's so safe. Music's very, very safe. You know, we've got X Factor, you know, and stuff like that. It's just so inoffensive, and nobody is really addressing what's actually happening at the moment. And then, for example, like Plan B, he released, like, it's Ill Manners, I think it's called, you know. And that is a great song, you know. It's taking punk and politics and protest, you know, back into the mainstream, and I've got a lot of respect for that guy, you know. So I'm proud to call myself a, you know, if that's what somebody wants to call me, I'm proud to call myself a protest singer rather than an X Factor contestant, you know.
I think given the current kind of political unrest and that kind of climate in the UK, yeah, I think we're definitely ripe for a new kind of breed of protest singers. Do you think we'll see a kind of rise of punk protest singers like yourself?
I do think so. Yeah, I think, but right across the board, I think one day, whether it's in a year, 10 years, or in a century, or even maybe not, you know, beyond our lifetime, you know, one day people are going to wake up to what's happening, you know, and they are going to stop being apathetic, and there is a revolution, so to speak, that's going to happen. There is going to be, you know, a big kind of final showdown, and I think it's starting to happen now. Obviously, you know, we've had Occupy, we had the riots last year, you know, people are starting to get peed off with it. And people like myself, I mean, I can't speak for other musicians, but I personally can't live my life day to day ignoring what I believe to be wrong, and I can't not do something about it. And the way that I can do that is express that within my music, really.
So are those all themes that will figure on your debut album, which you're working on?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, you know, I've got songs about sexism. I've got songs about... I've got a song called Love Me The Way I Am, which is a song about love and acceptance and gay rights. Also, naturally, got a song about Wakefield, where I'm from, a small town of Wakefield. It's called Shades of Hate. And, you know, cause basically, you know, growing up in somewhere like Wakefield, there's not much to do except drink and fight and touch each other up, really. You know, some people would argue that's a good thing, but personally, I don't. So yeah, there is definitely a political theme right across the album. Yeah, definitely.
And you're working with quite a few kind of interesting musicians and producers on that album, aren't you?
Yeah, the producer is a guy called Steve Whale, and he's like a former guitarist and songwriter in a very, very influential street punk band called The Business from the 80s. And engineering it is a guy called Pat Collier, who used to be in The Vibrators. And he's also like produced and engineered records, albums by New Model Army, who I toured the UK with last year. And I've got Jamie Oliver from UK Subs on drums, and on piano and organ, I've got Mick Talbot from Style Council and Dexys Midnight Runners.
So how did a young acoustic punk singer from Wakefield get to meet all of these legends?
Well, I think just being my usual sort of abrasive self, and how I met Steve, he was just kind of winding me up at Rebellion Punk Festival last year, because I played. I'm playing again this year too. And I was just kind of like, I just kind of like told him where to go. And I think he just kind of like my abrasiveness and my attitude, really. And it just all went from there. It's just been kind of a natural progression, really.
Who did you grow up listening to? Who inspired you to pick up the guitar?
Growing up, I was exposed to, obviously, it's a very cliche thing to say, but I was exposed to kind of a wide, you know, sort of range of music. You know, like my mum listened to like ELO and the Bee Gees and George Michael, you know, and I still love, you know, those bands. Everyone always kind of rips into me because I love ELO, but I don't care what they think. But when I was 12, I heard Bleach by Nirvana, their debut album, and that was the album that made me want to pick up a guitar, really. And I can only, like, a lot, some musicians, they have tons of influences, but I will just say, like, my biggest and only inspiration, really, initial inspiration was Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. And I bought myself, I saved up to get myself like a Jag, like a Fender Jag, so I could be like Kurt Cobain, you know. And then my mum, I remember when I was 13, because she totally hated everything I was doing. I have a really bad relationship with her still. She smashed my guitar up on the back step, like my you know, my beloved Jag on the back step of the porch of a house. And I wrote a song about it, and that's my song called Bullets, which is also going to be on my album as well. You know, it's just kind of one of those statements. Yet again, you know, an empowering statement to never, ever let someone tell you how to look, how to act, you know, and what to say. You know, you've just got to be yourself at the end of the day, and that's what that song's about. And, I think my adventure into guitar playing worked out all right, really.
That was Louise Distra talking to Charlotte Richardson-Andrews. Her album is scheduled for release later in the year. That's it for this week. Thank you, Michael. Thank you for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to come in. It God helps that I select the guests, of course. So.
It's not been signed to your own label. let us know your thoughts, as ever, at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. We'll be back in a week's time, broadcasting from the Great Escape in Brighton. We're
good
relocating.
Stuff coming up in next week's podcast.
Aluna George.
Django
and Aluna George. So Pop Bijou, there you go. More Aluna George. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.